All right, here it is, another Monday, which means another fresh Let There Be Talk for you, June 28th. Thank you for joining me. Episode number, what is it, 597. Wow, a few away from 600. I still cannot even wrap my head around 600 episodes, 10 years of Let There Be Talk. It is just mind-boggling to me, and I cannot believe it, and I want to thank all of you, like I always do, for tuning in each week. It means the world to me. I love it. I love your emails when you reach out, especially the ones I've been getting lately, like, wow, I never heard of this show. I'm a new listener. I'm binge listening to all the episodes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Leave a review on iTunes and subscribe on iTunes or YouTube. Let's get into the guest today. We got a powerhouse here today. We have got a powerhouse. I've been trying to have her on for 5 years or so. Orianthe is here today. Just a screaming guitar player, great singer, great songwriter. And what a story. What a story. I first kind of started seeing her around the Alice Cooper days when she was playing in that band. But I also remember her solo stuff, her videos. And, you know, she's got, what, 4 solo records out. Violet Journey, Believe, Heaven in This Hell, and Oh. And she also did a record, RSO, with Richie Sambora, Radio Free America in 2018. But really what blasted her, I think, into the world was she was playing with Carrie Underwood, and I guess Michael Jackson saw her and was like, I want her on my comeback tour. And boom, she lands the gig for the This Is It concert tour, starts rehearsing like crazy. You'll hear all the stories on here nonstop. I saw the documentary. It was just insane, the type of rehearsing they were doing. And then Michael dies, and of course, that ends that. But she has been playing guitar all her life, influenced heavily by Carlos Santana and all the blues legends. And at an early age, Jimmy Iovine grabs her for a record deal, and Santana asks her to jam. She gets a Paul Reed Smith endorsement. It's a great, great story. And it all came down to the NAMM show. And also grinding and hustling and sending out tapes the old world way. I love the story, and it was great to have her on. Thank you for doing it, Orianthe. Very, very happy to have you on. Before I do get into the episode, let's talk a couple things here. Over the weekend, I went to a cool vintage BMX bicycle show, which is something I do once a year, that Valley Relics puts on, and that was unbelievable to go out there and just relive my childhood once a year. It's just a straight up time machine. You just go there, and these people have some of the most beautiful vintage BMX bikes. Those things are works of art. They are absolute works of art. Most of the frames were made by racers' dads who maybe figured out how to weld and geometry and shit. It's crazy to think about BMX bicycles, the early days. It really blows my mind how organic that was. So it was great to be out there. And if you've not been to the Valley Relics Museum in Los Angeles and you're visiting LA looking for something to do, do not miss this. Right now they have the original VW van from Fast Times at Ridgemont High inside the place. I mean, this guy is next level. I had him on the podcast years ago, and he's got like all kinds of Bad News Bears memorabilia, all kinds of Valley relics out there, like signs from famous nightclubs, neons and stuff. So do yourself a favor and check it out. My dog Gertie right now is trying to just cover herself in a blanket, making noise while I'm doing the intro. What are you doing, Gertie? Gertie's got merch, by the way. I have turned into one of those weirdos where I believe people should wear my dog my dog's face and her name on their body. That's what kind of weirdo I am. I'm one of those people. Right, Gertie? So if you want to get some Gertie merch, go ahead and DM me on Instagram and I'll give you the info. It's fantastic merch made by the great graphic designer, Draplin, Aaron Draplin, who also I had on the podcast and who is a damn legend. So that was pretty damn cool to have Draplin do a Gertie shirt. Don't forget about Dark Fonzie or The Grail or At Home with Byron Katie, all on my podcast network. I'm a mogul. Did you hear that? I'm a media mogul. CactusRadioNetwork.com. You can find all the podcasts there. And I feel like I'm finally coming up for air. I started this network. I was like, all right, I'm going to start this network. It's during COVID. I'm going to start my own podcast network. And then all of a sudden, I was like, whoa, this is so much work. But I'm starting to come up for air a little bit. And I'm starting to do some stand-up shows all over. Not a lot of dates, but it's some dates, which means something. I've got next week, Cleveland at the Winchester. Cleveland, I'm headlining one night. Get your tickets at deandelray.com for Cleveland. Or the following week, I'm in Fort Worth, Texas with Jay Buchanan from the Rival Sons. He's going to be playing solo, and I'm going to be doing comedy. And who knows, maybe we'll jam one at the end. And then Sacramento Punchline, one of my favorite clubs on the planet. Looking forward to doing that. Also, I've just got the call from my man, Billy Burr. And I've got some great Bill Burr dates I'm going to be opening. August 13, Foxwood, Connecticut. September 29 and 30, St. Louis. October 1st, Red Rocks in Denver. October 2nd, Minneapolis. October 14, 15, 16, Atlanta. And November 6 and 7, San Jose. Those are the dates right now on the Billy Burr Tour. And shout out to my new Patreoners, John Lysett and Mastro John. Thank you for joining the Patreon. It means the world to me. I have 108 bonus episodes on the Patreon right now, patreon.com/DeanDelRay. And you can also join me every week for a Zoom fest. This episode is brought to you by CBD Lion. My number one sponsor. I absolutely use this stuff. I would not be promoting it if I didn't. I highly recommend if you have any kind of joint ache or trouble sleeping or anxiety, start up with some clean CBD from CBD Lion. Do not be getting that truck stop bullshit. This is the real deal. Clean CBD. It is third-party tested. They got incredible, incredible products. They've got some CBD gummies right now that are vegan. They have some pet tincture for your pet if she's going cuckoo and barking for no reason or whatever. All kinds of great stuff. I've been using the lotion for over 2 years now. I use the topical lotions and I also use the tinctures. I use all of this stuff right here. CBDLion.com. Use the code Dean, D-E-A-N, in case you forgot how to spell. Yes, CBD Lion. It helps me, it helps your pocketbook, and it helps a fantastic company. Family owned. So do not miss out on that. All right, I love all of you. I hope to see you at Cleveland. I hope to see you at Fort Worth, Texas. I hope to see you in Sacramento or somewhere out on that Burr tour. The candles are lit for Orianti. All right, here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. Fantastic guest today. Introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Orianti. I'm a crazy guitar player from Australia. How are you doing?
Great. I'm great. Great to have you on. I've tried to get you on for, I don't know, maybe like a long time, 5 years. I used to hit up Norm all the time, like, hey, see if she wants to do the show. And he'll be like, all right, I will. you know, Norm Harris at Norm's Rare Guitars.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's awesome. He's great. I've been in that store a few times. I've bought a couple of things from him, which I love. And you know, you just go in there when you're, you know, at the end of a tour, which is that's a good time to visit, you know, when you made some money, because there's so much stuff in there, so much shit that you're just like, I want it all of it. As a guitar player, it's like the worst place to go.
Oh my God. Yeah. I've been seeing him, I guess, for about 20 years. And it's just insane. You get, especially like I would say like 10 years ago, when he would be like, just come in this back room, that back room there, and just go ahead and look at it. And you're just looking at every case, and it's everything. You're like, how's this possible? Oh, yeah.
I know. He has everything. It's crazy. He has it hidden away. And then the last guitar I bought from him was this like gold, sparkly, I don't know, vintage, like, Fender Strat, which I love, you know, and it's awesome. And I traded a couple of things and bought, you know, and paid a bit for it. And then, yeah, I mean, it's awesome. It's one of my favorites. And then a few other guitars too in my collection. It's actually my storage unit's in Nashville, which is weird. I got to get to that.
Oh, wow. What did you used to live in Nashville, or just your gear goes there after a tour?
Yeah, all the gear, you know, I usually kept all my stuff there for like years. And then, you know, my management was over there before and I just kept it there. And then now management's here too in LA. So I'm going to move it over in the next like couple of weeks, which should be awesome because, you know, I have so much stuff over there. I haven't played for a minute. So I miss it.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I know so many professional musicians I talk to, they're like, man, I got so much gear. It's like, it's over at like Mates in a locker, or it's in, you know, it's in storage. And you're just kind of like, man, you got to go get that stuff or sell it, you know?
Oh, you know what? Some of it I am going to sell because I feel bad keeping it in the dark. Some of it I don't even miss, you know what I mean? Like, and the stuff you don't miss, you should get rid of. And that's the way I always look at it. And, you know, I actually sold a few guitars not too long ago because I'm like, I just don't play them, you know? And I'd rather get something I will play instead of just keeping them there and, you know, or in their cases in the dark closet. It's like when other people could really enjoy playing them, you know, because yeah, I mean, I do have a healthy collection of guitars, but I use them all. That's the thing. I don't just hoard. Some people like to hoard guitars just for the sake of having them. Like, oh, I have this guitar, I have that. But every guitar that I have, as I said, in Nashville, I'm going to get rid of. I use on records. I have distinct tones to them, personalities that, you know, especially when you're layering stuff up, you know, in songs and choruses and whatnot, I like to have a certain, you know, mix of guitars for that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you need your single coil guitars, your Strats and stuff and Tellys. Then you need your P90 yeah. stuff, you know, Les Paul specials. Mm-hmm. Then you need your humbucker stuff. Then,
you need
your cheap guitar for that weird Jack White tone. And, you know, then you
You're
need
completely
that,
right. You're completely
a couple
right,
custom made ones. Some guy made you that's a big fan, you know, and next thing you know, you got all these, you know.
Yep. And some of those are made really well. You know, the ones that come like, you know, they pay such attention to detail, right? And I have a couple of those guitars actually from fans. They're very, you know, made in the backyard from different trees and whatnot that they found. And they're made so well. And I love them. You know what I mean? They sound great. But yeah, that's the thing. And you go, and when I go to Japan, I used to love going there and just picking up cheap, like different sounding guitars for exactly what you were saying, that sort of alternative Jack White sort of sound that just, you know, you can't get from an expensive guitar or anything, you know,
no,
that's made really well. You know, it's just like that kind of bizarre tone for sure.
There's an incredible builder out in Nashville. He just made a Carina V for me, Mr. Banker. This guy is next level. There is a lot of incredible boutique builders right now, like this guy Carson Hess, Billy from Rock and Roll Relics. There's these guys around America that have taken boutique guitar building to the next level. They're obsessed with the old way, and they really go to town on them. And when you get the instruments, you're like, wow, this is incredible.
That's awesome. Yeah, and no, I love that. I love that. And, you know, as I said, especially a few of them that I have out here, you know, they're just made so well. I think one's from like Greece, another one's from like Nashville, and another one's from like New York or something, and, you know, Australia. And yeah, you know, it's like they just pay attention, you know, because they've done it in their backyard. So they just play so well. And I use them on records.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I know you're from Australia, and you're definitely in a different age category compared to a lot of people I have on here, because when I ask them what got them into music, it's either the Beatles or Zeppelin or Kiss, but yep. I'm not sure what it would be for you. What was it that said, oh yeah, I've got to do this?
It was like Robert Johnson, B.B. King, Carlos Santana, definitely Zeppelin, Cream, Elvis, the Beatles, all that. You know, my dad has an amazing record collection. So he's a guitar player, my dad. So when I was like 6 years old, I'd go in the living room and he would have, you know, the vinyl set out there. And listening to the Beatles for the first time, seeing Elvis Presley, Roy Orbison, Cream, everything. I mean, he just had everything. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. And he'd be playing along with it. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. And he taught me, you know, initially how to play. I actually started left-handed and then I switched to right.
Well, you
took
did?
The lessons. Yeah, because my dad's left-handed. So he's like, and I'm actually ambidextrous. So I can actually write with my left hand too, which is weird. But so I started playing left-handed. And then he's like, you know what? You should probably play right-handed because you have more choice in guitars when you go to a store. Because usually when you go to a store, there's like, you know, two crappy left-handed ones in the corner to choose from. So he's like, you know, you should probably change and since you can. And I was like, all right. So I did. And I couldn't put it down, you know. And then when I studied classical when I was 10. When I was 11, I actually traveled around Australia with this like production for Oklahoma. It was like I was in the orchestra pit sight reading and playing a lot of, it was really weird and fun at the same time. And then I studied classical, then saw Santana perform when I was 11 and picked up electric guitar after Dancer, Rainbow Serpent Tour, you know, after Carlos played Europa.
Oh, wow.
I was just blown away with that, you know, with his tone, with the song, with everything. I was just obsessed with his music and everything and just studied all of his records. And I got to play and jam out with Carlos when I was like 18. And he's been a friend of mine since then and just been a big supporter. And honestly, it means the world because he's the reason why I wanted to play electric guitar.
Well, you know, Santana is so underrated. I had Greg Raleigh on the show a couple times. I absolutely love Greg Raleigh in that early era of Santana and that monumental Woodstock performance, you know, that changed him the next day for life. And,
oh, yeah.
And also that Fillmore, I believe it's Live at the Fillmore, maybe 68. That's one of the great, great live records, man.
So good. I mean, honestly, like Soul Sacrifice, all those songs. I love, obviously, the Woodstock performance and the Fillmore, but I also, one of my favorite live Santana records with videos, VHS, actually, when I was watching it, is Sacred Fire, Live in Mexico. So that's in 92, I think 92, 93, I believe that was recorded. But it's just an incredible show. Like Carlos is playing, Santana's playing is just so inspiring. Like his soloing and everything is just, the whole band was on fire. I mean, and the audience, huge audience. I know how people like 50,000, maybe 100,000 people. And it's so beautiful. Like Samba Party, No One to Depend On, Open Invitation, all the songs he plays, especially Europa and that. So I just tell everybody to go and check out that live, you know, record or VHS. I actually wore it out because I would pause it and try to learn every solo off that.
So, oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of my favorites.
I love the early Santana, like I guess mid 70s, you know, when he kind of changes it up and he gets kind of into that, I guess it's almost African music, you know, but he's playing those crazy, you know, the very first boogies, the Mesa boogies with the. With that kind of, you know, weird grill cloth and everything. And his tone. And then, of course, once he gets into the Paul Reed Smith, the Santana Yellow, I'm just like, wow, this guy is just killing it. Yeah, with his tone, you know?
And that's the reason why I played PRS, because of Carlos. Because, I mean, I actually, like a brat, I was like begging my dad when I was like 11. I said, I need a PRS. And, of course, in Australia, they're very hard to come by and expensive. So we found a secondhand one from a country guitar player. And it had like, you know, he had this big belt buckle and scratched all the back of it and had really high action and heavy strings. And we found it. And I guess my dad, like just, you know, we got it at a pretty good price. It was still really expensive, you know, back then. And really heavy. It was from the old factory. It was a 1987 model, I believe, PRS. I still have. And I was obsessed. I couldn't put it down. I just fell in love with that guitar. And I've been playing them ever since. I was like 11. And it's just awesome to have their support and have two SE models with PRS and a couple of other signature models and working on a new one right now. So, I mean, honestly, it's pretty crazy. It's like the 10-year-old, 11-year-old in me is like, holy shit, like this is so cool. You know, it really is to be able to call the PRS family, like a family to me. They've been, supporters from since I was actually 14. I made my first demo and I sent it to Paul and he sent me an email, invited me over here to LA, and I couldn't come over at the time. Which is sure why I actually think management at the time there, because I actually saw my first management deal when I was like 14, 15 in Australia. And then I eventually came over to the NAMM show. I was like 18, 19 and just started demonstrating in the booth. And that's kind of how I got my record deal with Jimmy Iovine, was just playing at NAMM.
Wow.
And having a record that I did at home. I engineered it, produced it, wrote it, played everything on it, and then had like a press kit. And I was like hustling back then, sending it to everybody. I had this list of people like that I want to send it to. And then I sent it to just all these labels and I got a ton of rejection letters. And then Jimmy Iovine and Ron Fair wanted to sign me up, which was insane. And then I moved to the US and was like 20.
Wow. Now, Jimmy signed you to Interscope at the time?
Yeah, I was signed to Geffen and Interscope. It was both. Oh, yeah.
That was the Shut Up and Kiss Me era. Is that era?
According to you, yeah, Shut Up and Kiss Me, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because that's when I start hearing about you. I mean, I knew that you played with Alice, but I never saw you in Alice. But then I heard that song quite a bit on the radio and then found out about who you were. And then, of course, the whole Michael Jackson thing happens.
Yeah, that around, the time I was making the record with Howard Benson, we were nearly done with the whole album. I think it was pretty much done. I got a call. I was working with Diane Warren because I was like, you can never have too many great songs. I was like working with Diane and in the studio with her. And that's when I got the message through MySpace to say, hey, Michael Jackson's looking for a guitar player, exactly what he's looking for. We're going to give you a call tomorrow. Michael Jackson and Michael Bearden. So I got a call from them both and they wanted me to come in and learn Beat It. Want to be starting something in Dirty Diana. And it was literally like, I was in the studio with Diana. I said, I just got this message from like Michael Jackson and he wants me to come in tomorrow and play. And he's just like, what? I was like, crazy. I just remember that moment, and it was wild. It was a really wild time. And, just working with him was incredible. But then, obviously just devastating what happened and to the world. I mean, but everyone working closely with him for quite a few months. And because my album was ready and done, right? I didn't even tell the label I was working with Michael. They found out and then they were like, hey, we're going to put out the record now. And I didn't really have that much time. It was kind of a crazy time in my life, like going from rehearsing intensely with Michael to, okay, we're going to put out your first single and you're going to travel the world and do everything and promote it. And I didn't really have a lot of time mentally to sort of get around a lot of things. So honestly, when I look back on that, it was crazy, really.
Oh my God. I could imagine. I remember watching the film and what were you guys rehearsing at the Staples or the Forum? One of the two.
Both. We actually started rehearsing at Center Staging. Yeah. Then we moved to the Forum and then he booked out the Staples Center. We're just working at the Staples Center like every day. Crazy.
It's so insane, man. And it looked just grueling, like long, long, long hours.
Oh, really long hours. Honestly, we'd get there around about 10 a.m., 11 a.m., work through to about 1 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah, depending. And then some days were earlier, but, Michael was just, he was a hard worker. So he was working with the dancers. He was working with the production team. He was working with the clothes designers. He was working with the band. It was exhausting. I mean, just watching him, do everything, I was like, God, this is a lot, and the comeback and the pressure of that too, a lot of stuff people don't, put in consideration, like coming back after all that time and then putting together a show and then just making sure everything's perfect and the way you want it. And as an artist, it's, I think everyone around could definitely feel the pressure that he was like sort of feeling and, but excitement too,
Oh yeah. Yeah. Now you played with all different types of people, and different types of music from Michael to Alice Cooper. And then of course, a lot of the blues stuff you played at the Crossroads, Clapton's events and everything. And then your records, you know, have some poppy flavor to them and stuff. What is the actual, would you say, is the complete ultimate for you as far as style for you?
I definitely say blues rock guitar playing. You know, I mean, that's what I started playing, the blues and rock and everything. But I love a good pop song. So that's kind of what I do. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people just like hear bluesy rock songs from me and then kind of rootsy blues rock, and then, you know, a pop song I'll release here and there. You know what I mean? So it's kind of, I'm a fan of music, and I just think that it's good to change stuff up all the time, as a lot of bands do, a lot of artists do. But I mean, you know, my guitar playing, if I had to, you know, say what style it is, it definitely stems from the blues and rock. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's these guys and girls that play out there. And, you know, there's two types. There's a Steve Vai type where they have or Joe Satriani, heavy instrumental records and stuff. But then you've got the great John Mayer, who can also write the hell out of song. And yeah. I always feel when you have that combo, mm-hmm. It's deadly, because you've got this great song and then you've got this incredible guitar playing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mayer is a great songwriter. That's the thing. And I think it's about writing songs is really important. It's doing what's best for the song. It's writing melodies. It's not about just shredding till the cows come home. You know, it's like, that is fun. But at the end of the day, being an artist, it's about honing in on your songwriting skills. And I, you know, continually want to get better at that. You know what I mean? At the craft of like writing and changing, and every record I make to be really different. You know, this record I just made with Marty Fredrickson in Nashville was really inspired. I mean, it was 28 days we did it in, you know, it was really fast. After this sort of journey of writing and working with a lot of other people, you know, I was working with some Japanese artists, I was writing with different people, I was just guesting, doing different things. And you know, it was a lot of people like, oh, why did it take so long to make a record? It's like, well, it didn't actually take that long, 28 days. I just finished the RSO record, you know, my partner, Richie Sambora. And then, you know, he went off and he did his solo thing, which is awesome. And I'm doing my solo thing. But it was kind of this thing where it was like, you know, you just kind of, I don't know, you have to search and find what you want to put out. And I was working with hip hop producers. I was working with P. Diddy's camp. You know, it's like, wow. Mixing hip hop beats with guitars, and that turned out cool. But it wasn't, you know, I have all these songs and they're working with different pop producers that came in and out. And honestly, I had a whole pop record, you know, that was electronic. But I'm like, and I still have it, but I was like, that's not really what I want to put out right now. And so I kind of went back, and when I met up with Marty in Nashville, we just wrote Rescue Me, the first song. And then it just kind of felt like that was the sound. Like, I was like, you know what, this is going to be easy to make. I just get in the studio, and then I text him when I got home and I heard the demo. And, you know, because he's in Nashville and I live in LA, but he was working with Aerosmith at the time in Vegas as well. And I said, hey, would you have the time to produce my record? Because I just think it'd be great. And he goes, absolutely. And I've known Marty since I was like 20 years old. And when he was living out here in LA, and we just have a good friendship, and he's a great producer, songwriter. And it was fast. It was fun. It wasn't overthought. This record, I hope when people listen to it, they want to put it on their car and crank it up and jam along with it. And I'm looking forward to making the next record right now, because it's been, as I said, made it a year ago. Didn't think it was going to come out during like this pandemic, this whole crazy time, because you can't play shows. We, you know, playing a live stream and all that was kind of weird. You played like 5 camera people, and you know what I mean? Everyone's paranoid about each other, and it's just so it's off-putting, you know, it's like, holy shit. Like, you know, you want everyone to have had their tests done, and just getting out and even doing music videos. I mean, that's stressful. Everything's like, I don't know. To be honest, it's like, yeah, I just want to get back in the studio and make another record. And, you know, when everything's safe next year, it would be touring like 2 records, you know, and just putting all this energy into sort of just being really creative right now. So yeah, but I'm excited about this one, and I hope people dig it, you know.
A lot of people move into Nashville, and the music scene has really migrated there. Of course, it was country for years, but now there's tons of, you know, Brad Whitford's out there. Steve Gorman from the Black Crowes, some Rival Sons guys lived out there. There's a lot of rock out there now. It seems to me, if you want to be in it full on. It used to be New York or LA, and now it just seems Nashville. You could just be out and all of a sudden you're working on five projects.
You know what? I go to Nashville a lot to record and write, but I couldn't live there.
Really?
Yeah. I just think there's something about when I go somewhere to get inspired and get in the studio and write, I don't like to live there. It's weird. It's like, because then it gives you a sense of too much comfort. I don't know why. It's like, oh, this is my home. You know what I mean? Like, opposed to, I'm going here to create. I'm going here to record. I like that feeling of it being like I'm visiting to make this record and I'm going back to LA. And or, you know, when I make records here in LA too, I usually make them sort of in different spots around in, you know, I like to obviously record in my studio, but getting out of that and going to different people's studios and working, it's just, I don't know. I really like, as I said, I really like Nashville as an inspired place to write and record in, but I just don't see myself. So many people have asked me to move over there. You know, my ex-management wanted me there. Like, my manager before was from Nashville, and, you know, so many people are out there that I you know, I'm friends with, but I just, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just too many people moving over there.
Yeah. This could be the time more than ever to stay in LA, because then people are like, yeah, we need someone today. And it's like, everybody's gone. Oh, you know, it's like,
yeah, you know, that's the thing. It's like so many people, I don't know how many a day move over there, but it just seems pretty dense now. To be honest with you, like, I think that, yeah, it's like, it's kind of like such a normal thing. Oh yeah, I'm a musician. I'm moving to Nashville. You know what I mean? So I just rather stay in LA because I'm working on other things too. And yeah.
I mean, that's how Austin was like 20 years ago. Even, you know, during that kind of Stevie Ray era, a ton of people moved out there, got their Strat and the hat and hit Austin, you know, it was wild.
Yeah. You know, I love Texas. I love Austin. I love, you know, all the music's come out of there. You know, there's so many cool spots. I mean, and Atlanta too was, you know, where music was coming out of a bit. And then, as you said, New York as well. And God, there's so many different spots. And you know, especially for me, it's just staying inspired. That's the main thing, you know.
Well, I think a lot of people move, and what they don't understand, like back when the grunge movement happened in the early 90s in Seattle, people all moved up there. And what they didn't know is like, well, that whole thing happened 2 years before you heard all the records. So you've missed it already, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I see that you worked with my my boy, Nikki Six. He's a good friend of mine. That's pretty damn cool.
Really cool. Big fan, you know, and I actually didn't know Nikki that well. I actually met him because I left Alice Cooper just before the Motley Crue tour and, you know, joined with, you know, Richie, my partner, at RSO at the time. And we did, you know, I had to leave because it was like full on touring, you know. And but when I think it was about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, Alice was playing the Hollywood Bowl and Nikki came with his wife and they were hanging backstage and ended up just hanging out with them. And what great people. What cool people. And we just got chatting and talking about different things and just exchanging numbers and just going, okay, let's hang at some point, whatever. We just stayed in contact over text and talking, whatever. And I mentioned to his wife, I was like, oh yeah, I'm making a record. I'm having some guests and probably just writing whatever. Cause she asked us what I'm up to. And I said, if Nikki's down to write something, that'd be awesome. You know? And she goes, yeah, I'll ask him. And then next minute he texts me and said, hey, just send me some ideas and, you know, I can write some lyrics or whatever, however you want to do it. And he was around and sent me these amazing lyrics. And I was with Marty and Nashua when I got them an email called Stream the Consciousness. And it was just painting a really dark picture of LA, but in a really cool way, you know, really cool kind of dark Bowie lyrics, you know, and we just wrote some music around it and sent it back to him and he really dug it. And I was just, thank you so fucking much for doing that, dude. I was like, that's so awesome. You know, seriously, like I didn't expect, you know, I mean, I know he's like super busy and he's freaking, you know, writing for Motley Crue, but wow, you know, I was really blown away and what a super nice person and nice people, you know, I'm just really proud of the song. Hope people dig it.
Yeah. That song, the lyrics might be, about his, moving to Wyoming, you know what I mean? Like in his mind while he was writing, he was like, I'm getting out of here. I love that guy. He's fantastic.
Yeah. You know, just super, as I said, both of them, it's really sweet. Really sweet people. And yeah, I just thought they moved to Wyoming with the moose and on the Instagram is like lots of moose in the woods and everything's a different way of life completely. I'm like, okay, this is, that's cool. That's really cool.
It's gotta be wild, right? You're like, you're in LA all your, most of your life, and all of a sudden you just open your back door and there's like three mooses out there and, you know, and silence.
You know what? And I bet after living in LA for that long and everything, I enjoyed it. It's like good. It's a peaceful, healthy lifestyle. You know, it's like, I've been here like 16 years and it's crazy. So yeah,
it is crazy. It is crazy. Especially right now with the pandemic. I keep thinking like, how can we have the pandemic and rents and properties are more than ever, you know, like no one's working. How can rent be like $3,000 for one bedroom and a house be a million to starter?
Oh yeah. It's exorbitant. It's crazy. And, you know, I don't really know, to be honest. It's just exactly. It is crazy. I think I think everyone's, you know, especially the music industry, especially the arts and all that, we're really hurting right now with like the touring and stuff that's been canceled. And of course I'd be out on the road right now, you know, I'd be playing ton of shows, and that was a plan, you know, from the beginning of this year. So it's, everything's been turned around. And I know that a lot of productions, movies, stuff like that have been stopped, and you know, I was supposed to do this TV show before as well that got stopped, and a ton of things. And I just know a lot of people that are either, you know, really, I mean, mentally it's hard to get around too as a musician, because you make a record in order to go tour, and right, playing shows, there's a certain high that you get from that, and just, you know, that's what you do it for. It's like, that's the end goal. It's like, hey, you make a record, then you want to, you know, play it live so people can really experience it. And not being able to do that, and, you know, just doing other things. I took up painting, you know, at the beginning of this whole thing. I was like, I'm going to start painting. I'm going to start cooking. I'm actually doing a cooking show, by the way, really soon.
Oh, are you?
Yes. I'm excited about that. And some other things as well in the works. But other things, because honestly, not being able to tour and not play shows is freaking, it's crazy making, because it's like, you don't want to go out there and risk everyone's health, your own health, that everyone, you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy. And even doing a live stream show is exhausting. It really is, because you're worried about everyone on set. You know, you're worried about even music videos. It's like, right now I'm just going, you know, having a lot of meetings, label management, all that, and going, okay, how would you get around this right now? You know what I mean? To just make sure that it's, keep safe, keep sane, keep it together until it's time to go out there, because it is really stressful. And I know a lot of people, a lot of artists that are going, yeah, we've got to make a music video, but we're like really stressed out, because it takes one person coming on set that's sick, you know, and gets everybody sick, and that's happened, and you know, in rehearsals, or yes, I got my COVID test, and they're lying. So you just don't know, you know. It's like, you don't know what happens, especially if someone's feeling unwell and they come in. And you know, I've heard quite a few stories like that. Like, yeah, you know, it's just, it's crazy. So we've just got to keep safe until it's time for those gates to open, and, you know, safely go out there and have fun, bring people together. And I can't wait to see a live show myself, not only play one, but actually attend one. I was thinking the other day, like, you know, maybe there should be like an MTV or VH1 where they just like constantly play concerts, like just get, you know, like book out the Staples Center or somewhere like that, right? Where it's a pay-per-view, like we watch sports, right? But you have big bands play like constantly. So it's like, whether it be like the O2 in London and Staples here, and then you have another venue on, you know, whether it be in Australia or Japan, and it's, you know, you pay to watch live, like whether it be like a big band like U2 or whatever it is, and you have an opening band and, you know, experience from at home and whatnot. But it needs to be something like that for music, where, you know, still play shows in big places, but until it's safe again for people to attend. But that was something I was just thinking about the other day. I was going, like, these big venues too that are kind of hurting as well, you know what I mean?
God, you know, even the small venues are, I mean, it's a domino effect, like the Troubadour, the Roxy. I know you just did Whiskey, yeah, which is great. Yeah. And those type of places all around America where the musicians learn their craft, you know, nightly going out, playing clubs, 2-3 bands a night, and figuring it out, and, you know, waiting for the next Nirvana or the next, you know, Rival Sons or whatever's going to be next. Marcus King, these kind of people.
Love Marcus King.
Yeah.
Love. He's a big fan.
He's unreal, man. Unreal.
So cool.
But those type of people cut their teeth out on the road in these clubs before they got to the theaters and the arenas. And, you know, it's brutal.
Really brutal. And the Troubadour is one of my favorite places. You know, and the Whiskey out here, I played many shows. And, you know, I was just at the Troubadour at a party, actually, my birthday party in January. And, you know, it was like a BMG party there and other things going on. I had my party at the Sunset Marquee, which is my place. You know, they always would go to down there.
Love it.
And we had, it just seems like a couple of years ago now. That was in January when it was like I had a big party. We're all hanging out, going down to the Troubadour, checking out stuff. And I'm just going like, what the hell happened? You know?
No, wild. So yeah. Insane.
So crazy.
What is it like? I don't know. Do you date Richie Sambora or you guys just play together? I never dug into that. I just saw you guys together for years. But
we're together. We're together. And for years. Yeah, for years. Yeah, absolutely.
The reason I'm asking is on the songwriter basis, being around this guy then full time all the time. I mean, this guy wrote some of the greatest tunes with Bon Jovi. One of them being I'll Be There For You, I think is one of the greatest ballads done in that era.
Absolutely.
Masterpiece of songwriting. And
he's amazing. Truly. Yeah.
When you're around him, did you learn a lot of songwriting tricks and the craft of, I mean, I know they wrote a lot with Desmond Child and stuff, so I'm sure they learned a lot from that guy on how to get create a perfect hook, the ultimate chorus, all of that stuff, man. I mean, they just had so many massive hits and it's fantastic, his songwriting and guitar playing.
Oh, yeah. He's an incredible guitar player, incredible songwriter, you know, all of that. And we had a blast. We have a blast working together. We still write a lot now and everything. And he's awesome. And his new record's awesome. It's coming out. And, you know, the thing is with the RSO project and as the music industry is just crazy, a lot of things were going on, time and whatnot. And we took a break and all that. But it was just, you know, working with him, you know, Alice Cooper introduced us ages ago. And I was just like, yeah, we started jamming and then we ended up writing a few songs together and we're like, this sounds great. And I definitely learned a lot from him. I mean, he's written insane songs like that have reached so many people around the world. Yeah, just a real talent for sure. I worked with Desmond Child as well and, you know, we've all written together and it's just, you know, when people have that gift and Richie's an incredible lyricist too, you know, I mean, he doesn't just write. People are like, oh, he's a guitar player and he writes this song, but he writes amazing lyrics. So yeah, it was awesome to be able to create a whole album with him and tour around. And we opened for like Bad Company and we played a ton of shows, you know, for years and did all that. And it was fun. It was great. And I'm really proud of that record, the RSO record. When people listen to it, we actually wrote so many songs for the album that didn't even make the record. But yeah, that was a fun experience and working with Bob Rock as well and everybody. So
Bob Rock, what a master that guy was, you know, especially on the Metallica Black album.
Yeah, he's incredible. And, you know, he just knows how to get great tones and sounds, all that kind of stuff, and just really has a good sense of just music, you know, and everything. So it's awesome.
What are your amplifier preferences? Is it Marshall? Is it Orange? Are you into Matchless or any boutique amps? What do you like?
You know what? I've been through so many amps. I have a graveyard of kind of everything, basically. Well, in Australia, I have all the Mesa Boogies. Like I have Mark 1s, 22s, Mark 3s, 4, everything. Using Kettners, I have Music Man's, Fender amps, so much stuff. And then over here in the US, I had a deal with Marshall at one point, and then I decided to switch to Orange. And I have EVH, and then I don't even know how many amp companies I've been through, to be honest with you, but a lot. And then I decided, now I'm with Orange. I love Orange amps. Rockefeller Mark III.
Orange is killing it, you know?
They're so good. And, you know, Cliff's great. And, you know, they're just the owner and Pat Foley, amazing guy. If you haven't tried out the Rockefeller Mark III, definitely check it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They sent me just some little kind of small living room amp, which is cool. You know?
Is it the 15, the Rocker 15?
Yeah, yeah. So great.
Oh, my God. That thing is loud.
Oh, yeah.
Small, but brutal.
Yeah, the neighbors, if they come over and complain, I'm like, it's just this little amp right here. I don't know what your problem is.
I know, right? And that's the whole thing. It's like, it's funny because, you know, my studio is decked out. I have like, you know, Fender Champs. I've got everything in there, right, from whatever. But, and I have band rehearsal in my studio, which is actually like, you know, my condo sort of place. And there's no complaints, which is really weird because, you know, it's in a building and everything. But it's funny because we had full-on band rehearsal one day, and then the next day I had to do this thing with the Royal Machines that I was part of for a while. This band with like Billy Morrison, Dave Navarro, and Sebastian Bach, and everyone, you know, joins in, Matt McGrath. And we had to go to Florida, and I had to learn War Pigs, actually, by Sabbath. And I was playing it acoustic, right? So they wanted me to sing it and play it. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to learn it acoustically. I got 4 complaints. And I swear, like, it was just like, I just had full rehearsal, guys, with band, everything. My amps are on like 10. I was yelling. The drum kit was going, because I have a drum kit there in my place. And the next day, like, I'm literally playing acoustic in my living room, Sabbath. And I get 4 to 5 complaints of people just like, I know it is like Sabbath, like conjuring, you just go through the walls, like, you're too loud. I'm going, are you kidding me? I'm playing acoustic guitar. Like, you know, my cat's louder, you know, she's like freaking crying for her food. She's louder than the fucking guitar. So
it's hilarious.
It was crazy. It really is. I don't know. Sabbath.
Sabbath.
Yeah, something about it. Something about it.
Did you go see AC/DC when you were younger, living out there?
No, I actually saw AC/DC at the Forum when I first came over here to the US, and with my manager. And that's the first time I met, you know, my guitar tech, Takumi, you know, when he was working with them. And I went backstage, and I got to hold Angus's guitar and play it. Ooh. And that was wild. And I said hi to the band briefly, very briefly. And saw the show. I had earplugs in and my ears were ringing the next day. It was so loud. I mean, I had earplugs wedged in my ears. It was so loud. And then the next day my ears were still ringing. I'm going, that's rock and roll. That's the way it should be.
Oh, God. There's no one like them. There's no one like them.
They're insane. They're insane. I actually just did a tribute thing on, because I'm with Gibson Guitars now too, on the acoustic side. But I did do a Back in Black thing. I guess it was like an anniversary of that the other day. So
yeah, 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was really cool to be part of that for sure. Big fan. I mean, seriously, so simple, but so, I mean, all those songs, are you kidding me? Who doesn't want to play any of those riffs?
Oh my
Angus.
God.
Angus, yeah. Friggin' and Malcolm. And how just when you hear them live, when you watch them, you know, on a DVD or whatever, or you listen to the records, they're so tight. Like, their rhythm playing, the leads, everything. I mean, his vibrato, Angus Way just plays, and everything is just so perfect. It's so great, and it's so inspiring, and it's just so fucking cool. I think you get cooler than that shit, really.
You don't. You don't. It's them and the Ramones, and there you go. And, you know, there's like these three bands that never changed and always killed: Slayer, Ramones, AC/DC.
Oh my God. Yeah, totally. Totally. And, you know, and every, I mean, you see Angus play those, you know, riffs and everything. He's like, who doesn't want to play, you know, Back in Black? Who doesn't want to play? So it's like, it's insane. They're incredible. And I'm proud that from Australia. So it's
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And Gibson probably wouldn't be around if Angus wasn't playing that SG, because, you know, pre-Slash, you know, Slash brings back the Les Paul and people all want it, but, you know, yeah, without Angus playing that SG, it was totally that era of Jackson and Charvel. And so Fender and Gibson were hurting. And without Angus constantly playing that SG, I mean, you know how many SGs they probably sold? I know I bought 5 of them over my lifetime because of him.
Wow. Yeah, I have an SG. I love it. You know, they're just great guitars. I actually was with Gibson. Well, actually, one of my first guitars that my dad's, but I took off with it. It was a 125 Gibson, and he had it, and it was left-handed, and I just loved it so much. And then like a BB King 335. But I was with Gibson Acoustics ages ago, 2008, 2009. And then I stopped playing them, and I was with Martin for a minute, and then Taylor, and then PRS Acoustics. And then they reapproached me like last year, Gibson did. And they said, you know, come over and, you know, do a signature acoustic with us. And I'm like, hell yeah, that'd be amazing. So I went down to Montana And they said, which guitar would you like to, you know, make your signature? And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I looked at the J200 and I'm like, well, Elvis and, you know, Johnny Cash, everyone played J200. It's massive. It sounds amazing. But the only thing is about the J200 is a neck as a lead guitar player. It's not that playable. You know what I mean? Like I wanted to be smaller and just faster. So I'm like, can we modify the J200? And they're like, well, we haven't ever done that before. And I'm like, well, and they followed me down the rabbit hole. They're like, absolutely. And I said, well, I have this idea. Let's put an electric guitar neck on a J200. So let's put a 345 neck on a J200, modify the pickup. So the pickup actually picks up the entire body sound, because before I just found that the pickup was good, but it didn't pick up the sound completely. And also have the mids that you need as a lead guitar player to cut through when you're playing, you know, when I play a lot of corporate shows, a lot of the times the sound guys are out to lunch. They don't know what the hell they're doing. You plug in and it's like terrible. So I literally wanted a guitar that if the sound guy is drunk and stoned or just, you know, not even there, because half the time they're not even there, it sounds good. You can, you know, do it yourself. So I kind of wanted a foolproof, like lead solid guitar that can play rhythm. You can accompany yourself. Sounds amazing. I got to tell you, the guitar that we designed together, the hybrid J200, which is incredible, probably one of the best acoustic guitars I've ever played.
And it's red, right?
It's red. It's got amethyst, citrine, crystals in the pick guard for good energy. I mean, they really followed me down this freaking rabbit hole of like, I want to put the red on there. It's like this beautiful deep red. It's you know, everything about it is just positivity, you know, basically inspiring. I want to make a guitar that when you look at it, you get inspired. I want to pick that thing up. You know what I mean? So that's kind of, you know, the whole vibe of it all. When you, I swear, when you plug in this thing, it sounds insane.
Oh man. Well, that Montana acoustic factory is unbelievable. I did a tour with a J200 historic from Montana, you know, Blonde Maple, the classic J200.
And yeah.
Played it for a solid year on the road. And that thing just opened up and became this, you know, monster. And then I've got a 52 J45, a real 1952. And I call that thing the song machine. It's delivered, you know, probably 200 songs to me. And then I love the Hummingbird because of the Rolling Stones. The Hummingbird is just a classic, you know, so they kill it.
Honestly, and they're making guitars better than ever right now. I mean, it's just like, you know, I was using a Flying Bee the other day on the Sinner's Hymn thing. And, you know, I love their electrics too. Of course, I'm with PRS Electrics, but, you know, I was just checking them all out and whatnot because, you know, I'm a guitar fan, of course. And, but the acoustic side of things, they're killing it. Montana, amazing factory, amazing people. You know, Robbie Johns, who works there, and he, you know, basically did this guitar with me with LR Bags. We were over Skype. We're, you know, I stayed in Montana with Ray Levon. She's awesome. She's actually out here. So the Gibson rep, and we went out together to Montana. It was an incredible experience to walk around the factory, see how the guitars are made, see how they press the wood, see the different molds, see everything. You know what I mean? It was just picking out the neck, picking out the color, picking out the body, picking out just everything. I sat there with, God, I don't even know how many acoustic guitars I tried out, from the songwriters to the parlors to everything. And I was just like, you know what? I know the J200 is like a big guitar, but it works. It's great. And the neck on it now, it's so cool.
Before we get out of here, we got to talk about the, of course, when you auditioned for Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
You played the beat at Solo, and we lost Eddie Van Halen. It's absolutely the most brutal musician of my time and in the guitar world to be gone now at 65, so young, and just
so sad.
So shocking still. I don't know when you first heard Eddie, but can you tell me about that?
I mean, I first heard Eddie, you know, obviously with, you know, Van Halen and Jump and all that. I used to play it on Rage, is this channel in Australia, right? It's a music channel. And so it came on all the time and like, wow, what a monster player. And then obviously the beat at Solo, you know, and all that. And I'd always just thought of him as just like this incredible guitar player, but I wasn't into the shred as much. I just admired and just like looked up to him as like, wow, what a monster player. And then when I had to learn the beat at Solo and study, you know, playing everything, I was like, holy crap, like, you know, it's insane. And then my guitar tech at the time put me on the phone with him. He called and want to talk and say, hey, do you want to come over and jam? And I'm, you know, congrats on getting the gig with Michael. And he was so cool. And I never ended up going over to his place and jamming because, you know, with the rehearsals with Michael were so intense. You know what I mean? It was just like every day, basically. And so that never kind of happened. And I went on tour extensively myself after that. And it was just an honor to just even just talk to him and then have the congrats from him for getting the gig. And honestly, when I walked in there to try to play the beat, it's like, I didn't, like, you can't try to fill anyone's shoes, especially like Eddie's. Like, I'm going, holy crap. Like, I did actually the solo with my own sort of like thing to it. Like, it's more bluesier because I'm not that kind of player, but he's insane. And what a huge loss. I mean, as you said, to the guitar world, to the music world, to everything, and just such a talented player.
And a loss to the songwriting world, you know, like people they don't talk enough about, to me, we wouldn't be talking about his guitar playing if he didn't have these incredible songs. I mean, we would talk about him in a way of like, you know, the guitar nerds would, but this guy touched everybody with his amazing songwriting.
Absolutely. And, you know, I used to play Jump before every show, you know, after, you know, this is it thing. And I went on tour with my own band. Before I started, that would be my opening music. You know what I mean? Like, before I stepped on stage, would be Jump, because it always got me in a good mood. So insane. All of his guitar playing, as you said, the songwriting, everything, just about, you know, him. And yeah, so yeah, gone too soon. And I honestly didn't know he was that unwell. Cause my friend texted me and said, oh, something about EVH. And I thought he was talking about an amplifier. You know, so I didn't know that he had passed. And so I had no idea what was going on because I was working. And I was like, oh my God, wow. Wow. I just didn't know he was that sick. So yeah, so sad.
All right. Great talking to you. I'm so happy I finally had you on the show. I've been trying to get
you
on for a long time. And tell Richie, I said, hey, big fan, always wanted him on the show. And I hope to get to see you out there live next year somewhere and meet you in person, say hi.
That'll be awesome. Absolutely.
And then maybe you and Richie come down to the Comedy Store, see some comedy. That'd be great.
You know what? I'm a big fan of always watching that stand up and everything on TV. So big fan of that.
That's sure. Great. That's great.
Yeah, so got to check out your show.
All right. Thank you so much for joining the show and looking forward to seeing some more videos from you and everything. I just saw your video a couple weeks ago that you dropped, and that's a great one. I think are you playing a flying V in that one, or the photo shoot? You got a flying V.
You know what? Yeah. For Centers. Cause that's a crazy story as to my assistant actually shot that music video on her iPhone because I got a false positive COVID test.
Whoa.
So everybody ran for the hills because I was supposed to do a video shoot. And so that was a crazy time. So my band fled. So did the director. Everyone was like, okay, we're running away. Ari's got COVID. And so my assistant's like, well, if you have it, I have it. And the label were like, we need some video for this thing. So I'm like, okay, let's just shoot it against the wall. And it was fucking crazy shit. I got to tell you, because it was supposed to be a music video. And people were like, this seems very low budget for like the first video to put out with your album. And I got all this shit, right? And I'm going, guys, if you only knew what happened, okay? I had a whole video concept. Everything was cool. I was making a deal with the devil. It was going to be like this whole like crossroads thing. It was going to be fucking awesome. Location, everything. And then it was like, oh, I've got COVID. And then I had two doctors come over the next day to say it was negative.
Oh my God, COVID rock.
Holy shit, I know, right? So,
all right, yeah. Thank you.
Awesome, thank you so much for your support. Great chatting with you.
Thank you.
Take care.
See you.
Bye. See you later.